Use math to make the world a better place. Become an actuary through the Society of Actuaries and find solutions to the world's most pressing challenges. As an actuary, the only thing higher than the pay is the satisfaction.
The team at the Investigators and Burning Mountain Productions would like to remind you that persons associated with crimes or potential wrongdoing discussed on this episode are presumed innocent until proven otherwise in a court of law or administrative action.
Oh, I've been running from the law. Hope they won't shoot me down soon.
I'm Todd McComas.
And I'm Jessica Knoll. And we are
the Investigators.
Try to catch me howling at the moon.
Welcome back to all our partners in crime. We hope you had a crime-free week. And if you did not, we hope that everyone is okay and that you have the right investigators on the case.
And if you don't, reach out to us. That's what we're here for.
I had a blast this weekend.
A blast. I feel something's coming on with the word blast. I love it.
No pun intended, but my in-laws threw an incredible bash at their house, and there was fireworks, and not like just fireworks, like commercial grade fireworks. There was probably 80 people there at one point, people I didn't even know, and there was a DJ, like a DJ team, a three-person DJ operation.
I feel like you were at a rave. I don't know.
It felt like it. And there was live karaoke for 4 hours at this thing. It was supposed to be 4 hours. It ended up being like 7.5, 8 hours of karaoke. It was crazy. I took a nap at one point. I was getting a headache. I'd been drinking all day because I have a pool. So I started like 11 a.m. drinking, soaking up sun.
Look, I got to ask. I mean, you brought up 4 hours of karaoke. I got to know, did you sing? And also, what is your go-to karaoke song?
If I sing karaoke, it's usually Brown Eyed Girl, you know, because I kind of have the raspy tone. Or I slide into a little Bradley Cooper, Shallow. What's that song? Maybe it's time to let the old ways die.
Oh, I totally get A Star Is Born from you.
Yeah, so that's usually my go-to.
You might have to riff that on the on another episode.
Me and Bradley Cooper, kindred spirits. Mm. Anyway, about maybe 1:30, 2 a.m. And mind you, my in-laws live in a neighborhood. They don't live like way out in the middle of nowhere. They literally are surrounded by houses.
Didn't anyone tell you nothing good happens after midnight?
I mean, I woke up from my nap and the party is raging. The police had already been there once, I guess. So they show up a second time. Someone complains. It's like 2 a.m, probably a neighbor who can't sleep. And I'm walking. I go to the bathroom. So I'm walking through the kitchen. I get ready to go back outside. I just grabbed a beer. So I have a beer in my hand. And there is this young ass cop right at the screen door, looking right at me, and I get scared. Like I haven't been on this end of things it's like Black Mirror for me. So I'm like looking at old me, which is a young version of me, looking at old me now
with a beer in his hand after just waking up from a nap at midnight. Can we just make sure we set the scene, you know, like again?
Yes. And I can hear the music, people are singing, going crazy, and this cop's just looking at me like, I do not want to be here. And I'm like, oh my God, I ate a gummy. Now all of a sudden I have fear in my heart. Like, I'm not used to being in this situation, but then I'm like, calm down, old man. It was a Delta 8 gummy. It's totally legal in Indiana.
So you have drunk and gummy Todd on this shoulder and Detective Todd on this shoulder. And you're like, your mind's going back and forth of what the officer's thinking.
And I had to look guilty as shit because I'm trying to process these two voices in my head, right? And so I just open this door and I'm like, can I help you? And he's like, this is my second time here. So can we shut it down? And I'm like, are you asking me this? Because I'm like the oldest person at this party. And he was like, yes. And I said, okay, I'll take care of it. And he leaves and I shut it down. I shut down the whole party. I had to be an adult and like, sorry guys, party's over. And they're like, fuck the cops. There ain't nothing they can do. And I'm like, no, let's not fuck any cops. Let's just do what they say. So it was interesting because I hadn't been on that side of things since high school. Like when that cop was at the door, my inner 17-year-old Todd was screaming at me, run out the back door, run out the back door, hide in the cornfield, hide in the cornfield. They're like, nah, no, let's just handle it.
That sounds a lot like when I was an undergrad at college and there was a thing called May Days. And you still had classes, but you would wake up drinking, go to classes, come out and drink, take a nap at noon, get back up, drink, go to another class. I mean, this was a 24-hour, like, you nap and you eat and you drink, but you still somehow managed to go to classes in between all that.
The good old days, I call them. All right, enough about my near miss with the police. Everyone grab a shovel because we're getting ready to dig into this week's case. We're headed to the East Coast for this one, to a city that Family Guy creator Seth MacFarlane said he used as the model for his hit show's quaint small town, Quahog. It's my Peter Griffin impression. You're welcome.
I'll give it an 8.5. While this case is set in the real-life Quahog, Cranston, Rhode Island, this story has no quick-witted punchline by a snarky cartoon character, and it won't wrap after a 30-minute sitcom episode. That's because beyond the beautiful landscape and peaceful living, in the city named one of the 100 best places to live in America, something tragic happened just below surface level of this bedroom community inside a basement in 2006.
And at the center of this story is a 34-year-old single dad who worked as a carpenter. His story begins on the morning of Saturday, July 22nd, 2006, when he fails to show up for work.
His sister goes to his home that evening and finds her brother lying on the floor, face down, unconscious, in his basement apartment. And there's blood on him, under him, and on the furniture. At first, they think he's had a seizure, which is something his daughter says wasn't all that unusual. But the blood, the scene, nothing about that is normal to her.
His sister calls 911 and he's rushed to the hospital where he undergoes emergency brain surgery and remains in a coma in the ICU. He's removed from life support and dies on July 26th. His cause of death, blunt force trauma.
But if this was a homicide, it's a rare occurrence in Cranston, Rhode Island. In fact, in 2006, there was only one homicide reported to the FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting Database, and it was marked cleared.
But that was not this case, because his manner of death was declared undetermined. And man, we hate that word.
And so does his daughter, because she doesn't believe this was a natural death or even an accident from having a seizure. She believes this was a homicide, and she thinks his wounds, the scene, and everything leading up to his death proves it. This is Sean O'Brien's story. Natalia St. Louis didn't meet her dad until she was about 9 years old, but they hit it off right away.
We built stuff like we built a staircase in one of the apartments that we were living in. We just had really good experiences, like for the short time that we did have with each other. He was a really funny person. He was just a really good guy. Mentally and emotionally, he gave everything he had to everybody around him. He was a really good person. Like, he had some struggles and some stuff that he had to work through on his own, but he was a good person.
Okay, you've been read into Sean's case and you've heard from his daughter, Natalia. Now it's time to join us in the war room so we can take a deeper dive into what we know about his case.
We need to start from the moment this call came in to dispatch at 5:51 p.m. Take a listen. This is Sean's sister, Karen.
Sean!
Cranston Fire.
Hi, we need a rescue, please. 145 Pleasant Street in Cranston.
What's the problem?
My brother had a seizure, and he's been in it for quite a bit.
Is that a single-family home?
It's a one-family home.
Okay.
It's a duplex, actually.
145 Pleasant Street.
Yes.
We're on the way.
This call to 911 is the start of Sean's case.
Sean's sister tells the emergency operator that her brother has had a seizure. And the familiar language she uses, he's been in it for quite a bit, suggests that Sean has a history of seizures, and she's not only aware of that, she has experience dealing with him during his seizures.
Okay, so after this call, First responders arrive at 145 Pleasant Street. He's lying on the floor, wearing only boxer shorts, and he has a pool of blood beneath his head. Now let's hear from the emergency personnel en route to the hospital with Sean.
You make a notification of Rhode Island, 34-year-old male, possible heroin overdose, seizure activity. We have a line established, not cane on board, no change in his status, unconscious. We have him on a non-rebreather, ETA, 3 minutes.
Non-rebreather masks are used on patients who are still able to breathe on their own but require additional oxygen. I'm not a real doctor, but I do a lot of research on medical terms because, as many of you know, I do play a doctor when my wife and I roleplay.
Ugh, TMI.
And evidently, someone at the scene who knows Sean tells fire personnel he has a history of heroin use, so they administer Narcan as a precaution. And on the way to the hospital, they communicate to the ER that they do believe this is a possible heroin overdose. They were also told that he has a history of alcohol-induced seizures. Now, neither heroin use nor seizures in and of themselves explain the pool of blood, but obviously either could explain him falling from a standing position, which in turn could explain a wound to the head, mouth, and or nose. But we just got started, so let's not make any critical assumptions yet because we still need to examine the scene.
And you know what they say about assumptions.
Yeah, they make an ass out of you.
And me.
Yeah, I already said you.
Whatever. We'll get to the blood and the scene soon enough, but let's rewind for a minute because I want to take a look over Sean's timeline leading up to that 911 call. Let's take a look inside his world, beyond that basement room where he lived, and farther out to where he was and who was around him. Especially since there's a bit of a sordid backstory between him and a particular couple in his life. His upstairs landlord, Armand Rouleau, and his girlfriend, Lynn Halal. On June 8th, a few weeks before Sean was found unconscious, there's a call to police about a disturbance in the home he shares with them. Police arrive at the ranch-style duplex just before midnight.
According to Armand, they had been arguing about Sean being too loud, and he tells police there was no physical confrontation, but nonetheless, he wants to file a report and begin the eviction process. The officers are happy to take his report, and since Sean has a warrant for failure to appear in court, they lock him up.
We'll circle back to that particular couple again in a moment, trust me. But for now, let's go to the day before Sean was found, July 21st. Sean goes to work in the morning as usual. Then at 5:30 p.m., his girlfriend Amy and their 13-year-old daughter Natalia visit him at his home and make plans to go to a festival together later that night. But when Natalia complains of a headache, they cancel their plans to attend the festival. Instead, Sean asks Amy if she'll drop him off at Billy's Frosted Mug because he says he doesn't want to be home alone with his housemates. So Amy drops him off at that local watering hole around 6 p.m.
First of all, can we acknowledge how beautiful the name Billy's Frosted Mug is for a bar? They just don't name bars like they used to. You know, when you go into a bar called Billy's Frosted Mug, that as soon as you walk in the door, you're among friends. And one of those friends is going to get brained by a beer bottle before night's end.
Well, even though that's not what happened to Sean that night, he does fail to show for work the next morning.
And later that evening at 5:30 p.m., his sister Karen goes to his basement apartment where she discovers him unconscious on the floor. He's lying face down in a pool of his own blood. And this spurs her call to 911 at 5:51 p.m. Now, if you're doing the math, that's 21 minutes later. He's still unconscious when medics arrive and Cranston police officers are dispatched to the residence at 5:59 p.m. for a report of a man having seizures and not cooperating with rescue personnel. When Officer Sean Parker arrives, EMTs are carrying Sean O'Brien strapped to a backboard up the stairs. Officer Parker notes in his report that the man appeared to be conscious, which totally contradicts reports from rescue personnel who state that Sean never regained consciousness. Either way, it's interesting to note that police did not get to see Sean in the position or state that he was found in.
But what police did take note of was his room after he was taken to the hospital. Officer Parker notes that when he enters the basement bedroom, he sees several drops of blood on the mattress, and they look like they came from Sean's mouth. He also notes Sean's room doesn't show any signs of struggle. In fact, He refers to his room as neat and orderly. However, one of the Cranston firefighter EMT states the condition of the room was in disarray. Officer Parker also speaks to Armand, who along with his girlfriend Lynn were home at the time of the incident. He tells them he saw Sean around 5 p.m. watching a baseball game in his room. That's about a half hour before Sean's sister shows up. Armand then says he went downstairs a little bit later, time unknown, and found Sean on the floor. And according to him, he thought Sean was sleeping.
Honey, Sean's sleeping face down on the floor in a pool of his own blood again. Okay, well, don't bother him. You know he hates it when you interrupt his face down blood naps.
That's not a quote. That was just a fictitious recreation of actual events that only exist in Todd's mind.
In my mind, just so you know, isn't a whole lot of a safer place to spend time than Sean's apartment.
Well, let's get the hell out of your head then and go inside Sean's apartment, shall we?
Okay.
I want to take a minute to describe the scene and Sean more in depth, because we actually have statements made by the firefighter EMTs who responded to the scene and saw Sean and the room before he was removed and taken to the hospital. I'm going to walk you through a summary of those four statements. When they enter Sean's small basement bedroom, they find him face down on the floor, only wearing boxer shorts, which are soaked. His face is lying in blood on the floor beneath him. In fact, one is quoted as saying, "a lot of blood for a seizure." His skin is clammy and sweaty. He has dried blood on his face that is suspected as coming from his nose or mouth and had streamed down his face and pooled into his left ear. The blood on the side of his face is described as caked on. He also has a cut on his left foot and blood oozing from between his toes. He has what appears to be a bruise near his left ear, and there's also dried blood all over the stripped bed, drops of blood, and a large amount in the center of the mattress. At the top of the headboard, there's a rolled up sheet and blood stains, and at the top of the mattress near the headboard, there's a 15-inch circular red-brown stain. Also, inside the room, there are four or five crushed beer cans, but there's no odor of alcohol detected. Sean's pupils are fixed and dilated. His jaw is clenched tightly, so they give him concentrated oxygen and naloxone, and Sean doesn't respond to the Narcan they also administer to him.
Okay, notebook time. Write this down. Nose and mouth. Possible sources of blood. Ask hospital personnel about injuries specific to those areas. Dried blood all over the stripped bed and large dried blood stains in two different locations on the mattress. So that means there was movement. Sean was there, bleeding, and now he's on the floor, bleeding. Rolled up sheet on the bed with blood stains. Was he or someone else trying to control the bleeding before he ended up on the floor? And finally, a bleeding cut between his toes. What the hell caused that? Need to find the source of that cut. End of notes. For now.
Okay, riddle me this, Todd. How long does it take for blood to appear as dried? Because just 1 hour earlier, he was allegedly watching a baseball game.
Within 30 to 60 minutes, depending on environmental conditions. And I only know that because last night I was a hematologist and my wife was a hemophiliac.
Okay, weird. But also, his landlord sees him on the floor a little bit later, but he doesn't see all this blood?
Interesting, right?
Definitely. Okay, let's get back to the timeline. Sean's rushed to the hospital. And before he's done at the scene, Officer Parker checks in with the Rhode Island hospital, who tells him Sean's in stable condition and is being admitted for a blood clot in his brain, which they say could have been caused by a seizure.
Let's head over to the hospital, shall we? That's my impression of Jessica. Upon his arrival, hospital personnel note the following. Present condition, 34-year-old man unconscious with a question of a drug overdose. Past medical history, alcohol and heroin abuse. Admission examination shows blood found in right ear. Prognosis is poor given length of time with fixed pupils. And finally, preoperative diagnosis, right epidural hematoma, which means a collection of blood between the skull and the membrane that covers the brain.
Sean undergoes emergency brain surgery to alleviate the pressure on his brain caused by this hematoma.
Following his surgery, Sean remains in a coma in the ICU for 3 damn days. And on July 25th, he's taken off life support.
His cause of death is blunt force trauma to the head, and his manner of death is classified as undetermined. Let's take a deeper look over his autopsy by Assistant Medical Examiner Dr. Alexander Chirkov with the Rhode Island Office of State Medical Examiners.
Okay, instead of running through a list of complicated medical terms you're not going to know, which I have written down and memorized for later role-play scenarios, I'm just going to read you the medical examiner's final opinion. It is my opinion that Sean O'Brien, a 34-year-old man, died as a result of blunt force injury to the head with skull fracture, epidural, and subdural hemorrhage, and contusion of the left hemisphere. Circumstances of conditions related to injuries are unclear, so the manner of death is undetermined. Toxicology examination revealed the presence of cocaine, barbiturates, and opiates in the blood.
Okay, but something I found interesting actually happens years later, when Sean's now adult daughter, Natalia, sits down with Dr. Chirkov in February of 2022 to talk about her father's death and his examination of his body, a conversation she recorded, but because of the quality of the recording, we'll summarize it for you. She asks some important questions to note. While she acknowledges he had a history of seizures, she questions her father's positioning at the bottom of the stairs. She asks the medical examiner, if he had a seizure and fell down the stairs and hit his head there, would he be able to get up? Dr. Chirkov tells her, no, not with this type of injury. As for why he concluded the manner of death is undetermined, he explains to her, it has much to do about working with the detectives and what evidence they uncover to either support how the injuries occurred or how they didn't occur. Dr. Chirkov tells her he asked them how it happened, and they handed him a report that read he had a seizure and fell. His response to them was, the injury was not consistent with that story. He went on to say he can't list the manner of death as homicide because he needs them to say they believe there was a perpetrator, which would make Sean a victim.
Now let's clarify something when it comes to the manner of death in this case. Dr. Chirkov explains to Natalia that he did not have enough information in this instance to rule her father's death as an accident because that insinuates that it was an unpredictable action and that no one else is responsible. And he goes into a very wordy and complex explanation of why he can't classify this as a homicide, so let me more concisely describe to you what I know he was trying to say. This is what you need to write down in your notebook. The term homicide gets misused all the time. Homicide is not a crime. Murder is a crime. Manslaughter is a crime. Homicide is a manner of death, and it's defined by the Cornell School of Law as when one person causes the death of another. That's it. Very simple. If it weren't for the actions of another person, this person would not be dead. Manner of death, homicide. So what Dr. Chirkov was alluding to is this. For homicide, medical examiners do not concern themselves with motive or intent. That's for the police. Medical examiners only need to know whether or not the actions of another person, known or unknown, resulted in this person's death. Here's a good example. I'll play the part of the medical examiner, and Jessica, you play the part of the detective.
Oh, so I'll be Todd McComas.
Yes, let's do that. Okay, ready? And action. Okay, Detective McComas, why is this guy dead?
Someone shot him. They were.
No. You can shut up now. I only need the first part. Doesn't matter to me if it was an accident or on purpose. I'm a medical examiner, not a detective. That's for you. So pack up your shit and get out of my office. You've been here for hours, and I have no idea why, but I'm starving, and you're cutting into my lunch hour.
Okay, but...
I said shut your stupid mouth and get out. I know you don't want to go home to your wife because your second marriage is falling apart even quicker than the first one, but you need to get the hell out of here. Your pathetic life is not helping my examination into this man's death. End scene.
You know what? Just so y'all know, Todd is actually on his third marriage, so that was just a little nugget of historical intel and a little sad. A lot of sad. But good for you for making it as realistic as possible. And also, don't suck me into your twisted-ass role scenarios. I'm not your wife. I am on my healthy first marriage. Move on.
Noted. So in Sean's death, this medical examiner did not feel comfortable classifying it as natural, accident, suicide, or homicide, even though pretty clear to me that's what he wanted to classify it as. So he had no ethical choice other than to list it as undetermined.
And another big issue for him, at least medically speaking, is that he performed Sean's autopsy post-surgery. So there's no way to determine how many times his head was struck to cause that blunt force trauma. He knows the injury that killed Sean, but how he received the injury, that's the piece of the puzzle he's missing. And he tells Natalia he can change his 2006 ruling for her dad's manner of death if he gets new information from police that fits the cause of death injury and or that someone inflicted said injury. And even though Dr. Cherkov was missing information he wanted when he signed off on Sean's manner of death, he managed to provide police with enough ammunition to apply for a search warrant. Here's a quote from their application. When police consulted with the medical examiner's office, Dr. Cherkov concluded that the magnitude and extent of the trauma to Mr. O'Brien's head was inconsistent with the fall that would be caused by a seizure.
Finally, get inside the damn apartment, roll up your sleeves, and do some good old-fashioned police work because that medical examiner wants a reason to change Sean's manner of death. We all do.
Well, we're about to get what we're asking for, at least a search warrant. Because not only did they get a warrant with the ME statement, but it was also bolstered by witness reports, which spurred further suspicion of foul play, including the conflicts between housemates. But also, and get ready to start a new page in your investigator's notebook, because witnesses reported observing Lynn carrying a lamp out of the house prior to rescue personnel being summoned. The lamp is, quote, capable of causing blunt trauma / deadly force. But this search of the house didn't happen for days after Sean was removed from his room. Anyway, they were still able to seize dozens of items from the scene, including a bloody pillow, a bloody t-shirt, bloody sheets, bloody pillowcase, sections of mattress with blood, a bloody towel, and they collected swabs of blood.
Obviously, executing a search warrant for a death scene that's been left unsecured for as long as this one has is less than ideal. Because important shit, and by shit, I mean evidence that was there to be collected 5 days ago, could have been cleaned or removed by now. We know for a fact they found an empty jug of bleach at the scene, so it's possible shit was cleaned, and that's not good. But what we're concerned about right now is finding something to provide to the medical examiner to change Sean's manner of death. We need to find a weapon or something that was used as a weapon. Something like that lamp that witnesses said they saw Lynn leave with right before the police were called.
Why would they wait to secure the scene until he died? If there was that much blood in different locations at the scene when he was discovered, why not secure the scene at that point? I mean, did they have to wait for his autopsy?
I mean, it is a death scene with suspicious circumstances, so me personally, I would have secured it until I knew if he was going to live or not. And if he dies, which he did, I'm going to keep it secured until I get the autopsy results. I know that requires posting an officer there 24/7, but come on, this is police work we're talking about. Now, out of the other side of my mouth, that's me and how I was trained and how I'm wired. I'm not going to say this regime should be punished by not doing this for why EMTs were all but calling a heroin overdose, because the medical shit isn't their job, and they should be able to trust the folks who do have that job. So I'm going to take most of the heat off the cops, but I'm going to leave just a little bit because, in my opinion, any trained investigator who couldn't see in the first 2 minutes of walking through Sean's apartment that there was way more to this story than a heroin overdose should be passing out flashlights for a living, not investigating crime.
Well, here is some investigating they conducted. A detective talks to Armand at the police station about Sean's incident and seeing him in the basement. But at some point during this interview, Armand requests an attorney. Todd, when you're interviewing someone and they ask for an attorney, what's going on in your head?
Back then, that person has something to hide. That's what I'm thinking. I'm just being honest. And maybe that something involves this person's death, or maybe it's something else that I want me to find out about, but they got something to hide. In today's world, a little bit different. Pretty much, I'm still going to think that in the back of my head, but today, you do have to allow a little more room for justifiable fear. I mean, Netflix has made a killing, no pun intended, on the backs of documentaries about people that have served a lifetime in prison for crimes they didn't commit.
That's a very valid point. And you and I have been doing this long enough that I don't know about you, but if I start to feel an interview moving into interrogation mode, I'm probably going to ask for an attorney.
I almost told that cop at the party I wanted an attorney.
But we digress. Back to Armand. He does consent to a search of his house and allows them to photograph him at the station before they follow him back to the house. When the detectives arrive on the scene, an officer who's already been there keeping an eye on the house is given the task of starting a crime scene roster. Let's talk about why something like a crime scene roster is so imperative for a scene, especially this one, in which we don't know yet is the site of a crime or not.
Crime scene rosters, or crime scene logs, as we call them, are crucial for multiple reasons. It gives the detective a list of everyone who entered the scene so you can get elimination prints and swabs from them later if you need. Because you don't want to be operating off the assumption you have the suspect's DNA on something at the scene just to find out way down the road that DNA profile belongs to an officer. That's embarrassing shit. Secondly, that's your witness list for court. You just hand that right to the prosecutor. And finally, if there's confusion later about who found what, you can go through that roster and track down each person on it and ultimately find out who found what. I got an example. Here's a case I worked one time. It was a kidnapping case. They held this woman for ransom. It was a real deal, $250,000 ransom. We end up tracking the guys down from their phone calls from phone booth to phone booth, swoop in, grab them up, and save this girl who was duct taped and tied up in the bathroom of this shitty motel. Now, we had three scenes going on. There was her house where she was originally abducted. There was this hotel at the end where they saved the girl who was being guarded by one of the kidnappers. And there was this car where me and the other guys caught the people who were placing the ransom calls. Now, my job after that happened was to interview all five suspects. So I'm tied up for hours on end in another part of the post interviewing. By the time I get done, I find out I'm in charge of evidence. As soon as I get into my office, all the detectives' desks are covered with evidence. Everybody who seized anything from all three crime scenes just went in there and dumped that shit. And probably a third of it was labeled with who seized it and from where. But luckily, some Johnny or Joanne on the spot trooper at each scene kept a crime scene log. So I was able to go through the logs, track down each officer, and then say, okay, what did you find and where did you find it? And it saved our ass at court. So yes, crime scene rosters, crime scene logs, very, very important.
Okay, got it. By the way, did you get a conviction there?
Oh yeah, held up on appeal too.
Crime scene roster for the win.
That's what I'm saying.
All right. Very important here. Okay. So moving on. While at the house, one of the detectives sits at a table in the backyard with Armand and Lynn. He asks Lynn if Armand told her how Sean was positioned the first time he went to the basement and saw him. Armand pipes in trying to answer for her, but the detective stops him, reminding him that he can't speak to him because he's already requested an attorney. Lynn tells the detective she can't remember. He pushes her, asking if Armand told her how Sean was positioned the second time he went down to the basement. Again, Armand tries to answer, and again, the detective reminds him of his right to an attorney, to which Armand changes his tune and says he no longer wants an attorney and wishes to answer questions. He's read his rights and signs a document to that effect and begins talking to the detective along with Lynn. When the detective notices scratches on Armand's face, they both admit to a scuffle, a physical altercation between them that happened Friday, July 21st, one day before Sean's incident. And with that, Lynn is arrested for assault and battery.
This is a case of, I'm tired of messing with you two. You just gave me a reason to lock one of you up, so I'm going to lock you up. Maybe after you sit in jail for a bit, you'll be a little more forthcoming with what I need to know. That's what that whole thing's about.
So while she's held in jail and charged with domestic violence, she's taken out of her cell and interviewed by two detectives, noting it as a suspect interview.
The police department withheld the detective's report, so we don't know what questions they asked, and we don't know how Lynn answered them.
But what we do know is Lynn has a history of violent behavior. One year earlier, on January 16, 2005, she's arrested for felony domestic assault, specifically citing domestic assault person over 60 years of age. In that arrest report, the victim, a 69-year-old man, tells police that Lynn, his living girlfriend, came home intoxicated with a beer bottle in her hand. He said she came into the bedroom and jumped on him in a rage. He went to the kitchen and began to empty a 12-pack of beer because he said he feared if she continued to drink, she would become even more violent. When she saw him throwing out the beer, he says she grabbed him by the throat and scratched him. He went back to bed when he says she filled a large measuring cup with hot water and threw it at him.
This chick has a temper, a violent temper, the kind of violent temper they write songs about. And it's not like we're trying to exploit that, but come on. She ran out of the house with a lamp that has a metal base right before the police arrived. And that lamp never made its way back into the house. And we can tell the medical examiner thinks someone struck Sean in the head with a blunt instrument. So at this point, it's a math equation.
No, I don't do math, Todd. It hurts my head. I need words, not numbers.
I did fail algebra, let's be honest. So the listeners can just let us know on social media if this explanation was just another epic fail. Here we go. A plus B equals C. A is Sean. B is the cause of his blunt force trauma. And C is Sean dead on the floor of his apartment. So we need, and the medical examiner needs, to identify the value of B. Now, is B this freaking missing lamp? Maybe. But let's abandon math for now.
Thank you.
Let's take a look at all the evidence that was collected during the search warrant, which was for the entire residence, which includes the living quarters of the landlord and his girlfriend, Lynn. They tested several items for DNA, and the results came back in May of 2007. That's nearly a year after Sean's death. Now, let's see if the results can help provide Dr. Cherkov with what he needs to change Sean's manner of death. Testing concluded that Sean's DNA was present in blood recovered from a chair in the dining room, a love seat, a green towel, and a pillowcase. Now, the problem is the police haven't released the report or search warrant return that would tell us if these items were located in Sean's living quarters or the landlord's living quarters. Obviously, it would be a game changer if the dining room chair, love seat, towel, and pillowcase were in the landlord's living quarters, because Sean's blood on those items is evidence of transfer. So if that was the case, that would mean someone with Sean's blood on them entered the landlord's living quarters and started touching shit. Obviously, this transfer is far less significant if these items were in Sean's living quarters, because then it would be assumed Sean was the source of transfer.
Hang on to your britches, Todd, because that DNA report does name a suspect. Any guesses?
Just 'cause you say I'm crazy.
But Lynn has never been charged with his murder or manslaughter or any other crime associated with a homicide in this case, ever.
Plus, Jessica has no idea I replaced my initial response with that song clip. Being the editor does have its benefits. But back to real business, Lynn was listed as a suspect, which as far as I can tell, she should be. She has a possible motive. They're in an argument with Sean sometime prior to him being found by his sister. She has a violent temper, a history of violence against others, and a witness put her at the scene during the time Sean was likely injured as she was seen leaving the house with the heavy-ass lamp. So she had opportunity, and motive plus opportunity equals suspect. Now, she's not been charged with a crime yet, but that's simply because there's absolutely no physical evidence to support that. Yet, as the great Denzel Washington said in Training Day, it's not what you know. It's what you can prove.
But that hasn't stopped Natalia from trying to prove someone was responsible for her father's death. She's been relentlessly requesting more information and more sit-down meetings with the main players in his investigation, trying to get answers and justice for her father. The Cranston police chief has responded to some of her queries, and in an August 14th, 2019 letter, he writes to her that Sean's case remains open, but is inactive pending receipt of new information, and that a detective is assigned to her father's case should anything new surface. 2 years later, he then tells a local news station that detectives garnered a lead about that missing lamp. They tracked it down to a state landfill, but unfortunately, they never found it. On April 25th, 2022, the chief responded to more requests from Natalia.
Again, in a letter, he wrote in part, "The Attorney General's office has also concluded that there is insufficient evidence to conclude your father's death was due to foul play. And the medical examiner who handled your father's case remains steadfast in his conclusion that he cannot classify your father's death as a homicide."
And while that statement is technically true, it's only true because he wants detectives to say they believe someone injured Sean and that he died as a result. Right now, according to the medical examiner, the reports read that Sean suffered a seizure and was injured from a fall caused by that seizure. And here's my quandary. I'm not a fan of the police documenting guesses, but to say Sean suffered from a seizure and fell is a guess. Probably even more of a guess than writing in your report that you believe someone caused the injury that killed him. Because at least that is consistent with the medical examiner's findings, where the seizure and fall theory is not. So is this just another case where each side wants to blame the other side so neither has to make any moves? I don't know. It makes me wonder. Because as far as I can tell, everything needed to change the manner of death is right there. Just freaking type it up.
Right. Because it was actually typed in the DNA results document that they do consider Lynn a suspect. Boom. Person. There you go. But instead, here's what the chief actually typed up in his latest letter to Natalia. Quote, "Your father's death has never been determined to be a homicide by the medical examiner's office, and the investigation has been closed. Absent any new information coming to light, the medical examiner's office routinely conducts independent investigations of sudden deaths and bases its opinion on the manner and cause of death on specific medical information gleaned from an autopsy examination," which is not exactly what the ME told her. Anyway, he goes on to say that the detective is available to consider any new information or evidence that warrants reopening the investigation.
Well, that's nice.
But on June 23rd, 2022, Natalia receives a piece of paper that stops her in her tracks, especially one word on that piece of paper, revealing a glimmer of hope. Independent forensic pathologist Dr. Bao from Illinois gives a statement with his conclusion in an affidavit after he reviewed the original autopsy, stating, "Cause of death, skull fracture with intracranial hemorrhage due to strike by another person. Manner of death, homicide, not undetermined." Despite these new, albeit independent, medical opinions, her father's case remains unsolved, undetermined, and closed.
It's all lip service, baby. No one wants to admit they made a mistake so the victim's family has to suffer. A story we hear all too often. But let's hope in this case, these particular agencies eventually get their shit together and help put us two out of a job.
I mean, man, Todd, what kind of podcast would we do when all these cases get solved? Comedy? Like Abbott and Costello?
Probably not. More like Key and Peele. But for this one, that's everything we had access to thanks to his daughter, Natalia St. Louis, who has been nothing short of a warrior for her father, Sean O'Brien.
Natalia keeps a small, very worn and faded post-it note from her dad close to her, especially now. It reads simply, "Hey, good morning, girls, sleepyheads. Thank you for lunch. This is the best feelings that I ever had. Really love you guys. Love, Daddy." July 21st, 2006 was the last time Natalia ever spoke to or saw her dad. It was the last time she saw him smiling at her and heard him say the words, "I love you," to her. The next day, he was found fatally wounded in his home and never woke up. While he was still fighting for his life in the ICU, the then 13-year-old, praying for a miracle, wrote a letter to him. It read in part,
"Daddy, they say only the good die young. Growing up in Silver Lake, I know you probably don't fit into the good category. So you should live forever. At least at 34, that's not a very long life. And I know in my heart, God takes us when we're ready. But you're not ready. So I'm waiting for the miracle to happen now, for you to open your eyes and be okay. For all of us to snap awake and say, oh, it was only a bad dream."
But for Natalia, Well, she's never been able to wake up from the nightmare. And today, she has a real-life message for him. Something as a child, she never got to say to her dad.
From an adult perspective, like, I appreciate you for doing all that you did to get by, to make, you know, my life worthwhile, to make our time together worthwhile. I'm appreciative of the both of them, but I'm appreciative of him for giving it as long as he could. He gave it all he could for as long as he could.
She appreciates everything, but it's the little things, like the snapshot moments together, that will forever live engraved in her memory.
It was like that anticipation of being on a trip and all of those things. And he had worked like a half day. He was a construction worker. And my mom and I, we'd gone to pick him up from a job site. And my best friend was in the backseat. And it was just like everything was right in the world. Like everything was the way that it was supposed to be. And on the way back, we got lost.
Nothing will ever truly be right in the world now that he's gone. But today, she hopes to find her way in bringing a resolution to his death investigation. But unfortunately, there's no map for that.
There is something you can do to help Natalia and Sean. Natalia is offering a $1,000 reward for information leading to an arrest in her dad's case. Actually, let's make that $2,000 because Jessica and I would like to double that. So if you have information that can help, please call the Cranston, Rhode Island Police Department.
You can also visit the website she created for him, justiceforseanobrien.com, and the Facebook page with the same name. From there, you can share his case and his story, and we'll also keep you updated on his case. In the meantime, if you have a case you'd like us to dig into, reach out to us at investigatorspodcast.com. That's also where you'll find links to our social media and the show notes for this episode.
If you like our show, tell a friend. And tell that friend to tell a friend. Word of mouth is our favorite form of advertising because it comes from people who care. And it costs exactly $0. Also, if you like this show, take a minute to rate and write a review. And if you don't like this show, maybe just keep that shit to yourself. And if you're coming to CrimeCon in Orlando this year, please find Jessica and I so we can slap high fives and talk a little crime.
Yes, because we're so excited to meet all of our partners in crime in person. We'll be on Podcast Row at the Burning Mountain Productions booth. Until next week, take care and take care of each other.
And most importantly, please don't freak out on your boyfriend's downstairs tenant and hit them in the head with the heavy ass lamp. Because if you do, you might have to deal with us. Because we're the investigators!
I came from the mud, there's dirt on my hands. Strong like a tree, there's roots where I stand. Oh, I've been running from the law. Hope they won't shoot me down soon. Catch me howling at the moon.